on.
Now you can share the topics that drive the discussions of your favorite talk shows with TalkStream Live's topic-driven talk radio.
We gotta talk. Take a drive.
List and promote real-time talk radio topics, or post the topics that you want to hear. Hot topics are tweeted and retweeted, and include simple click-to-listen audio links. The future of talk radio is topic-driven talk radio. Available now at TalkStreamLive.com.
He became a millionaire by the age of 30, but ended up in bankruptcy, losing it all by the age of 40. The amazing story of one man driven to the brink of death after becoming the victim of an embezzlement scheme. After planning his own suicide, he turned to God and discovered a secret so powerful that it changed his life forever. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle is more than just one man's story of beating the odds and rebuilding his life after a total financial collapse. It's a book that reveals a life-changing prayer method that anyone can use to find hope during life's darkest financial trials. You will learn how to enlist God's help in solving your financial problems. The biggest prayer mistake most people make when approaching God with a financial need. How prayer can provide you with immediate answers and direction to your most pressing financial issues. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle, an Amazon.com bestseller from James L. Paris, the editor of ChristianMoney.com. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle, available in paperback or for Kindle from Amazon.com. You're listening to Jim Paris Radio.
This is Jim Paris Live, your source for money and political conversation from a Christian perspective. And now your host, the author of more than 20 books, and the editor-in-chief of ChristianMoney.com, James L. Paris.
All right, hello everybody, and welcome to another edition of the broadcast. Great to be with you. Tonight is going to be a little bit of a different program. First of all, you should know that we are not live. We are pre-recording this program. And I did that for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's Father's Day, so I thought it'd be great to spend the day with my kids, which we're going to be doing that a little bit on Saturday also. But then also trying to get a guest on Father's Day might be difficult as well. So we thought we'd go ahead and do a pre-recorded program, so we are not live tonight. You won't be able to call in with your own questions, but we have a fantastic guest lined up for you tonight. His name is Ian Punnett. I'm sure you know the name if you listen to AM radio. I'm a big fan of Ian Punnett and his years on Coast to Coast AM. And he's going to be with us in just a moment to talk about his new book, How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. And yes, that is the title. I've already gotten a lot of flack from people about the title. They can't believe that I'm posting that on the internet, that yes, I'm doing an interview on that, and I sure am, and I'm looking very much forward to it. Before we get into the interview today, a couple of quick announcements. Our brand new website, InfoFawcett.com, is live, and this is the idea that we came up with a few months ago, where we would bring in multiple contributors, multiple writers to work on this multi-blog platform with us. And it's got a profit-sharing model and all kinds of neat features. If you want to check it out, InfoFawcett.com, lots of great content there. And if you want to be a writer for us, you can check that out as well, InfoFawcett.com, and then click on the button that says Become a Contributor, and you'll see that there as well. All right, without any further delay, I want to welcome someone to the program. He's never been with us before. We have a lot in common, though, and I'll start by telling you that we're both from the Chicago area. We both have books out on prayer, and we've both been in radio for many, many years. So, Ian Punnett, good to have you with us.
Where around Chicago are you from, Jim?
I am from Bridgeview, 7900 South Harlem Avenue.
Okay, well, so you're from Chicago proper. My wife is always fond of pointing out that I'm not actually from Chicago. I'm from the suburbs of Chicago, as
well,
she is
right.
Chicago in it. So
yeah, I mean, I actually fought my way through high school, and I don't exaggerate.
I bet you did.
Yeah, and you're a North Sider, so you would be a Cubs fan, and I'm a White Sox fan.
Well, see, where I grew up, we were allowed to be both. You didn't have to choose sides. So I had the great advantage of being able to go to both, and I loved both. I mean, I had the autographs from the 73 White Sox, which was a great team and had Wilbur Wood on it back then, that great old baller. And I just, Carlos May, wasn't he on there? And those are great teams. So I just love baseball. So you're far
enough north that you could kind of be for both. Now, the neighborhood that I'm in, you would get beat up if you were a Cubs fan. I'm not sure if that's why I stuck with the Sox or if it was my own choice.
No, I think that's totally fair. The neighborhood, you know, where from which I came, I would get beat up on the South Side just for being from that neighborhood. So, you know, we were all considered cake eaters and whatever. So I had many fond memories of going to the South Side, but I also had fond memories of leaving the South Side of Chicago.
Now you're an interesting guy, and I have to tell you that. Over the years of listening to Coast to Coast, and my wife has always given me just the hardest time for listening to Coast AM. I'm one of these people, I don't sleep well at night, and so right. I like a little bit of ambient noise in the room, so I will turn on, I've got a little iPad set up in there with a speaker connected to it, and I listen to Coast many times while I'm half asleep at night, which is about the most sleep I usually get. And I remember one guest in particular that I did not hear the end of it for weeks, a guest by the name of Jason the Horse.
Oh, yeah.
And as much as my wife was not happy with me listening to Coast AM, the UFOs and all that stuff, when you had the guest on, Jason the Horse, I was humiliated for weeks. But thing was, the guy was so convincing.
Yeah, that's
that
the thing.
It was interesting. It's like, if he's not a horse, this has got to be the best impersonation of a person that thinks they're a horse that I've ever heard.
Well, that's very well phrased. And you know, this is a guy who achieved some level of notoriety. It all started with an email. He had sent me an email explaining his predicament of being a horse soul trapped in a human body. And as preposterous as that sounded, I wrote him back and I was, you know, just being nice. And then he responded back. The more he started talking, the more it was like, okay, that's so specific. He knew, like, the farm he was on. He knew the type of hay. He knew everything about his life. And when we had him on the radio and people started calling and saying, okay, if you're a horse, then what would you do under the – and he got every single question right. I mean, it's a weird thing to try to entertain, but whether it's ever true or not, it made for great radio.
Yeah, very good. And for people that aren't familiar with Coast to Coast AM, they have a Monday through Friday program, which is on really late at night. It's like 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And I was actually on with George Norrie in January. He had me on during the first hour to discuss my book on prayer. And that was a lot of fun. And I'll tell you what, people can laugh about Coast to Coast AM, but I got more response from that one hour.
Yeah.
Than any show that I've ever been on, and I've been on all of them, and I got more response. Literally, my Kindle book, the Kindle version of my book, actually crashed, and it took Amazon more than 2 days to bring my Kindle version back online. That's how many people went to it, and that was just from a one-hour appearance. That program has a huge, huge listening base, doesn't it?
Well, I'm sure yours does too. So I'm looking forward to this appearance quite a bit. So thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I've been especially touched by in listening to you, and we're going to get to your book here in a moment, is your health struggle with tinnitus. And
yeah, it's pretty awful.
Yeah, you know, and for people that don't know what it is, it's a horrible, debilitating sickness. And you know, I have to compare maybe to what Rush Limbaugh was going to years ago, where he was losing his hearing, but yet he'd go on the radio and still, you know, you could hear him trying to modulate his voice and he was trying to do his show. And I was so moved by his efforts to work through that. And the same with you. You know, you have just struggled through this, and I can't imagine what that can be like. You're retiring now officially from Coast to Coast AM. Are you going to retire from radio completely, or is it just this
all
extra
radio
show?
No, in
all
fact,
radio.
I've already. Yeah, I had been doing a full time show every morning with my wife, who is the co-host on a talk station in the Twin Cities, and I had to, by doctor's orders, we cut that down to 2 hours a day, And then when that didn't really bring about any relief, we just had to, I had to not renew my contract. And so my wife has continued on without me, but that my last full-time show was December 31st of last year. And then I just thought I'd hang on for a little while longer to see whether or not one time a month or so would be too much for me. And it just, I can't, it creates too many problems the day after. Tinnitus or tinnitus, as some people call it, it's a kind of a whistle buzz or a ringing buzz that goes on inside your head. It's a neurological condition. It's not actually something in the ear, although it feels like you're hearing it. I really can't take it anymore. So I just had to say, as much as I love radio, it was time to find a new direction. So that's where I'm heading in.
Now, as we set up our interview now for the book, I want people to know a little bit about your background, which is, as you lay out in the book, a pretty interesting contrast between a guy doing radio talk shows, morning drive shows that would kind of be considered, I think, in some, I think some people would say a shock jock type of morning shows. I've never heard your morning show, but
right.
That's sort of how I think some people might describe it. But yet at the same time, you become an ordained minister and you're sort of living these two different lives, many people would think. Share with us what that's been like, being a shock jock in the morning, but then also being an ordained minister.
Well, yeah, I'd say just to begin that I think for some people, being a money manager and being a Christian might seem incompatible. And I think that those two things can go together quite well. I've always been a big believer that that any good theology is a happy theology, and that gloomy theology by nature is bad. When we make a joyful noise, to me, there's nothing more joyful than laughter. And so I just kind of focused on the fact that as a Christian and as a broadcaster, I could influence people's day so easily by making them laugh, by helping them get to work in a better mood, to being topical, but at the same time being funny, that there was nothing that was incompatible about that with my faith. And the fact that people came up to me all the time and said, "Oh, your show puts me in such a good mood," just made me worry less about whether the joke was G-rated or PG-13. And so the restrictions of radio being what they are, you can't really do R-rated jokes on a commercial station. So to me, that wasn't even in play. But yeah, sometimes, do the humor, flirt the line of Saturday Night Live? Yeah, but I live with that. And I don't find that particularly shocking. And I think it's fun. And most people, I think over the years, have validated that by inviting me to their churches. I preach in pulpits all over, regardless of denomination. And I've been serving in an ordained capacity as the deacon of St. Clement's Episcopal Church in St. Paul, Minnesota, for about the last 5 or 6 years, and several other churches before then.
Very interesting. Now, let's start at the beginning here, the title of the book. Me just promoting that you were going to be on
to talk about
a book called How to Pray When You Are Pissed at God. I'm getting angry emails from people just for having the word pissed and the word God in the same sentence. And I can't even imagine what the meetings were like with the publisher about that title, because I've been there, written over 20 books, and I know what those meetings are like. Tell us about the title.
Well, I can't even imagine writing 20 books, so that's a kudos to you. I mean, that's amazing. It was surprisingly a no-brainer, honestly. The truth of it was that this was something that was said to me so many times when I was talking to people in the capacity as a hospital chaplain. And people were coming up to me. I interned twice as a hospital chaplain, both at a southern hospital and a northern hospital. And I would hear that line said to me, just in the different way, they would say, and if you want to, Jim, by the way, we can just we've established the title of the book, and if you want to, from this point forward, you don't have to keep saying the title. I have no shame in it, but
I have no problem with it. Yeah, I've almost read the entire book, and I know what you're doing here, so I have no problem with it. Because it's real life. It's real life.
It is. And it's where it's sort of, you know, sleeves rolled up faith. And where I was hearing people telling me all the time that I've come on in, chaplain. I need you to pray for me because I'm just so pissed at God. I don't know what to say anymore. And that's when I wished I'd had a book like this to be able to put into that person's hands. And what the first thing we would try to do is talk about their anger and the fact that there are lots of people who pray angry in the Bible. And that this isn't an invention. It's nothing new. This is something that scholars write about. It's just not talked about necessarily in polite company. And so, you know, for people to whom this is an unfamiliar idea, no wonder they get, you know, mad, and they're sending an email, and I don't blame them for that. It's got to seem a little shocking, but it's not. In fact, that's why I believe the Bible has these prayers in them. It's to help us understand the role of anger in our lives, and to be assertive with God is not to be unfaithful. It's to make a claim for who we are as a child of God and saying, I don't understand why this is happening, either to me or to this person that I love. And whenever we do that, whenever we make this claim that I am really mad about this, we stand with angels, and we stand with the psalmists. The largest category if we break the Psalms into different categories, like, you know, praise Psalms and royal Psalms, the largest category is the Psalms of people who are unhappy with God, who are unhappy with the things that are happening to them. Lament, to me, seems like too passive a word, and many of the Psalms in the Bible, a long list of them, are called the imprecatory Psalms or the curse Psalms, and they literally call for God to do horrible things. But these people are in pain, and they really are acting out of that pain, and they're demanding that God give them the sort of justice that they seek, right or wrong. And that by the end of the psalm, if we sit down and we read these, we see that most of those people feel better. They sound better. The end of the psalm is different than the beginning of the psalm. And that's part of the beauty of learning how to pray when you're pissed at God. If we take our anger to God, we can feel better. Maybe not the first time, maybe not the 10th time, but we can feel better about the things that are plaguing us if we're willing to risk that much in our relationship with the divine.
And, you know, I wonder many times how much of our anger at God is based on unrealistic expectations. And I share with you my youngest, who is 18, my youngest of my three, just graduated from high school. So my wife and I went to her high school graduation a week ago, and she graduated with better than a 4.0. And we're, you know, all excited, you know, proud parents. And you look around and you see all this hope, and everyone's talking about their future plans. You know, you've got the valedictorian coming up, and people are talking about, well, I'm going to be a lawyer or a doctor, or I'm going to be a multimillionaire entrepreneur, and everyone has all of these wonderful plans. And you look out at that audience, and you know that a certain percentage of those young people are going to end up with cancer. A certain percentage are going to end up going through a divorce. A certain percentage of them are going to get scammed and lose all their money like I did. Or they're going to go through one or another heartbreak. They might be in a tragic car accident. Who knows what it is? But we seem ill-prepared for life's darker side. We seem to come into life almost with a Santa Claus expectation that it's all going to be great. And then when we start seeing the reality that it's not, that's when the anger begins to build. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that you're looking at the duality of so much of what we read in the Bible. And we have great promises in the book of Proverbs. If you play by the rules, Proverbs tell us, if you do this, you're this, life will be great. And then you have the Song of Songs, or you have Ecclesiastes, you have other things that come in and go, especially Ecclesiastes, you go, well, that's really different. And looking back now, my life wasn't that good, or that didn't live up to its billing. And you kind of have to live in that, and you have to sort of recognize it's one thing to be in love. But along with love is going to come perhaps some disappointment, and we have to be able to process that disappointment when it happens. And as people of faith, our expectations tend to be very high. We think sometimes that prayer and Bible reading and lots of hymns and other things can build like a force field around us that can keep out these horrible things from happening to our lives. And then when it doesn't, well, then what? And that was really the case of, how to pray when you're pissed at God. This book came about from people who were people of faith. And they may not even have had unrealistic expectations, but they had higher expectations than what was developing. I mean, why should a mother of three, who had been a good mother and a good wife, why should she be suddenly, coming down with cancer when there's a person who's robbing people of their life savings across town who's going to live a long, happy life sitting underneath a South Florida sun? Right. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
And that's where the anger comes in. And so many of us struggle with this issue. I just wrote my Amazon review a few moments ago on your book. One of the things I said there, I gave you 5 stars, by the way, which I would have given you more, but that's all they let me do. I said, I wish I had this book, myself 10 years ago, because I think I was in counseling for 5 years after I uncovered that my brother had embezzled from me and wiped me out financially.
It was your
and
brother?
It was my own brother.
Dude.
So here I am. I'm in counseling for 5 years, and probably the truth is that most of that counseling, in the end, it probably was that I was angry at God and didn't know how to process that. I was angry at myself for not being, a better careful manager of my businesses, but I guess when you get to the point where you can't trust your own family member, it gets pretty discouraging. But I felt myself in many cases, I was at that point. I remember my wife one time said to me, she said, just pray and let God have it. And I thought, wow, right. that's a really weird thing to say to me. How can you do that? You envision a lightning bolt coming down from the sky. I mean, can you really talk that way to God? And then you mentioned in your book how Jesus himself asks God the Father, have you forsaken me? He's on the cross. And so we see that, as an example for us. I mean, obviously, we don't get everything in the Bible that happened during Jesus's life. He lived many, 33 years, but we don't hear everything that happened. But obviously, that's something that was important enough for us to be able to have that today. And there's probably a good reason for that, isn't there?
Well, you look at the line, how important that line is. My God, why have you forsaken me? It was so important that in the Bible, and in almost every Bible, I guess some might take it out, but in almost every Bible, that line, regardless of the translation, is kept in its original Aramaic. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. That line is exactly what Jesus said. Jesus would have spoken in Aramaic, not Hebrew. Hebrew was official language. Aramaic was the spoken language. And so we actually have the words, not just the translation. And how important is that for us to know that that's what he said? And it's the first line of Psalm 22, not the 23rd Psalm, not the more rosy, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. But this is Psalm 22, a psalm of pain and frustration and confusion. And it's so much more powerful to read Psalm 22 knowing that's the clue that Jesus was giving us as to what he was feeling. And he wasn't feeling protected. He wasn't feeling like God was answering his prayers. How can you be so far from the words of my groaning? I mean, this is something that people feel when they're in pain and frustration. And yet, when in many cases as a hospital chaplain or as a deacon or working with people even through the media, when you say this, it can be like a lightning bolt or a light bulb moment where they just say, oh my gosh, that's exactly how I felt. I can't believe it was there all along waiting for me to feel good about. Now, as for saying something angry and being hit by a lightning bolt, I remind you of one of my earliest inspirations for this book came from the Poseidon Adventure. The character played by Gene Hackman is of this defrocked minister. We don't know what he did. We think he broke the rules of his church, not in any, you know, not through sex or money or anything. He just being difficult. And he, at the beginning of the movie, in the Poseidon Adventure, he establishes the fact that he, you know, he has this very authentic relationship with God. And he prays angry at two occasions in that movie. That is such a forward thinking kind of a thing for a disaster movie, an Irwin Allen movie. You know, I mean, that concept of him standing up to God saying, "How, if you're not going to be with us, don't be against us." And yet, not to spoil the Poseidon Adventure, but the Gene Hackman character dies. And in my 11 or 12 year old brain, when I saw that movie, I thought, that's about right. That's supposed to happen. You can't do that and live. And right. That would be how the world would make sense in a way, except that the Bible doesn't tell us that. And those pages that are there from the people who stand up to God, even Job, they thrive. And the people that stand up to God, they're not punished. And they seem to be rewarded for having that kind of an authentic relationship. And I think we will be too.
The name of the book is How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. It's available everywhere. I see it on Amazon. It's in all the bookstores as well. Is that right?
Sure. Yep. Random House, Harmony Books.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of the big publishers. And if you want to get a copy, you can check it out over at Amazon.com as well. Before we go to our break, I want to hit you with something else. I thought this was rather funny. I'm reading this directly out of Chapter 1. On a Sunday in November 2010, Buffalo Bills receiver Steve Johnson was so angry after having bobbled what would have been a winning touchdown against the rival Pittsburgh Steelers that he tweeted this to many thousands of followers. Quote, "I praise you 24/7, and this is how you do me. You expect me to learn from this? How? I'll never forget this, ever. Thanks, though." No word on whether God actually follows Steve Johnson on Twitter, but apparently a lot of God's followers do. Hilarious that you make that reference. How much does it matter if the circumstance that we're in is because of our own fault, where we've bobbled the ball, or it's just a tragic circumstance that has nothing to do with our own our own doing? How much does it matter in terms of how we approach God with a prayer regarding that situation?
Well, you know, I spoke with Steve Johnson, and I wasn't allowed to include all of the interview in the book. Some couple of moments, he was so candid on the phone with me on this, and his feeling was not that he was mad at God because he had bobbled the ball. He was mad at God because he had never before ever bobbled the ball. It was a new thing to him. He had always felt this connection that if I do right and I live right, then the right things happen. And this was like the first time that he felt almost like God knocked the ball out of his hands.
Wow.
But he said something to me which I thought was really cool. He was raised by his stepfather. And his stepfather was a deep person of faith, and his stepfather always told him that, you know, good or bad, it all comes from God. And he based his life on this. If you look at the life of Steve Johnson, some people consider him kind of arrogant, but I found him to be fascinating and a really sweet guy to talk to. And he was just still getting his head around the fact that God had decided to knock that ball out of his hands. And he couldn't understand why. It would have won the game. It would have brought glory to God. He would have been the first one to say praise God afterward. And so he tweeted that out almost without thinking, because everything he'd ever had was an authentic conversation with God. And that was just part of it. So it wasn't so much blaming God for, oh, I didn't get to be the hero. This was a conversation that had been going on for years before and will go on for years afterward, a real authentic relationship saying, God, I know you're there for me at every moment, and even when you're not, I'll try to learn from them. And he was saying, in this case, I don't think I'll ever learn from this. This one is so overwhelming to me. I don't. And then at the end, What does he say? What are the last two words that he says there, Jim?
Oh, I don't know. I just flipped to another chapter. I'm sorry.
Oh, in the tweet, the last two words are, thanks, though.
Oh,
he's
okay.
He's not being sarcastic.
Yes. Right.
He is actually feeling better, and he says, thanks, though.
All right, I read that as sarcastic, but, you know, I see that other side of it. Absolutely.
He wasn't. He said he wasn't. He really meant it. Thanks, though. Thanks for everything. He just.
And it is interesting, though. You know, I love that story, but I always find it fascinating how the level of importance that we put on sports and sporting events. And, you know, I mean, people will be a mess for weeks that I know if their team doesn't win a certain playoff game or whatever it is. And we have all these other bigger problems going on in the world. But that's another story. We're going to take a break. Ian, this is a four-minute break, so you'll have a chance to stretch your legs. And we'll be back with Ian Punnett. The name of the book is How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. We'll be back with more with Ian right after this break. Stay tuned. Hello, everybody. This is Jim Paris, editor-in-chief of ChristianMoney.com. You know, a couple of years ago, I was out in my neighborhood walking my dog, and I happened to notice an individual cleaning out a foreclosed home. And I do live on one of those streets where there have been a lot of foreclosures. In fact, at one point in time, there were actually five empty homes right on the street that I live in Palm Coast. So I struck up a conversation with this individual that was cleaning out this house, and he shared with me how much money that he was making simply cleaning out foreclosed homes and how busy he was. And it really got me thinking about how many people could benefit by getting this information. So I started doing some research to really ask the question, what would be involved in starting up a business like that, the business of cleaning out foreclosed homes? And I found an online course that I think is fantastic. I actually purchased it myself to check it out to make sure it was something that I could recommend. And it goes through the entire process of how to get started in a business like that, how much money you can charge, how to bid jobs, what licenses, if any, might be required in your area. And the author outlines the entire process, actually showing you how you can make between $500 and even $1,000 or more per day just cleaning out foreclosed homes. If you'd like to find out more about it, I want to recommend to you the website foreclosurecleaning.us. That's foreclosurecleaning.us.
He became a millionaire by the age of 30, but ended up in bankruptcy, losing it all by the age of 40. The amazing story of one man driven to the brink of death after becoming the victim of an embezzlement scheme. After planning his own suicide, he turned to God and discovered a secret so powerful that it changed his life forever. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle is more than just one man's story of beating the odds and rebuilding his life after a total financial collapse. It's a book that reveals a life-changing prayer method that anyone can use to find hope during life's darkest financial trials. You will learn how to enlist God's help in solving your financial problems, the biggest prayer mistake most people make when approaching God with a financial need, how prayer can provide you with immediate answers and direction to your most pressing financial issues, how to pray for a financial miracle, an Amazon.com bestseller from James L. Paris, the editor of ChristianMoney.com, how to pray for a financial miracle, available in paperback or for Kindle from Amazon.com. You're listening to Jim Paris Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Jim Paris, editor-in-chief of the website ChristianMoney.com. You know, about a year ago, I started getting concerned about the cost of our family's health insurance, literally costing us thousands and thousands of dollars each year, and the cost continued to go up and up and up. And I started doing some research into an alternative called Christian Medical Sharing. And I learned that through a special law, a special provision, Christians are able to opt out of Obamacare and actually get into this alternative to traditional health insurance called Christian Medical Sharing. I decided to go ahead and move into a plan like that, and I'm saving a lot of money. Now, if you'd like to find out more about it, get more of the details to find out if it's for you or not, I've written an article on it. In the article, I give you more details, including I actually mention the organization that I decided to go with. If you'd like to get all of the information on this and find out if it might be for you, check out this website, medicalsharing.christianmoney.com. That's medicalsharing.christianmoney.com. All right, we are back. This is Jim Paris, and we are talking with Ian Punnett. The name of his book is How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. And I have to tell you, folks, you can read my Amazon review over by the book, but there was a couple of times I had to set this book down because my eyes were filled with tears. I have to tell you, because I've been in some of these situations before, and the one probably most moving part of the book for me was the story of the hospital room and the young man that was in the motorcycle accident. And, you know, I can relate. I was in one situation. I honestly didn't know what to do or what to say, but I got a phone call that my cousin, who grew up in Bridgeview, south side of Chicago, grew up four doors down from me. My dad's brother lived that close to us on the same street, and they had six children. So we were very close, almost like brothers, growing up. And he went on a vacation driving from Chicago to Denver. And on that trip, his wife was driving, and she fell asleep at the wheel, and the car went off the edge of a cliff, and it was the two of them and their four children, and they all survived except one of his sons was killed at the age of seven. And I was so devastated. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. I got on a plane, and I flew there, and I walked up to my cousin, and I just said to him, I said, Tom, I don't know what to say, but I love you and I'm here. And it was just really like a ministry of presence. That was all I could offer him, because I was so crushed myself by the whole situation. And I want you to share with us the story of the young man in the hospital and the motorcycle accident, because that was just very, very moving to me.
Well, first of all, I'm so sorry that happened. And you did such the right thing. And it is all that we need to do is to express a ministry of presence. We don't have to make it right. We don't have to pull out any theological mumbo jumbo that tries to justify why this had to happen. That's an error to think that that's something that we need to be responsible for as a person of faith. All we have to do is be there with that person at that moment, and if they want to talk with them, no matter what they want to say, we need to hear it and not correct them, and not to feel like it's our job to sort of, at this very crazy time where nothing is making sense, to try to pound everything back into the box that, you know, was life before that accident happened. And that's not unlike what happens with the hospital chaplain. When you go into a room, you're not there to make sense of it. You're not there to reorder the world. You're there to just be with people as they are talking about what they're going through. And if they call upon you, if they ask you questions, do your best. But there's the real prohibitions against evangelizing under circumstances where people are in pain. If they want to ask you, that's fine. But in this case, this was a boy where I was being called into I kind of felt a little bit like I really didn't need to go into this room. And the circumstances are changed from the events of the real story to protect the family. So everything I'm about to say is a sort of fictionalized version of it, but the truth remains the same. And that's the parents weren't there, but the boy's aunts were there. And they were very, very excited, and they had a whole room set up, and they were praying, and they looked great, and you know, they had a very orderly table of snacks that they had put in this room that the hospital had allowed them to use while their nephew was in the pediatric intensive care unit after having had a crash on a motorized recreational vehicle. And he was in a concussion. There was brain damage. He was not responding. Nobody knew what the final outcome was going to be. But these aunts were just so chipper, and they were so sweet, and they brought me in, and we were talking, and then there was just these moments, these flashes across their face, where you could tell that there was something going on. And the something that was going on was doubt as to where God was in this. And those that was one of those times where I just in allowing people to say what they were experiencing, they started to talk about how could God let this happen to our nephew? Where was God in protecting this little boy? And the family was trying to seem like they were really good every time their pastor came to visit. But when their pastor wasn't there and it was somebody different, it was me in this case, they were much more willing to be honest and forthcoming about that. And when I broached the subject with them about anger, and that had come up because one of them expressed, I'm just so mad. And so we talked about that and said, well, do you want to pray through your anger, not around it? And we started talking about righteous anger. Another story comes to mind, not in there, but the story of Jesus cleansing the temple of the money changers. That was a righteous anger. God, you know, knows that Jesus was mad, but he was mad for a reason. This was wrong. And when we get mad about something that's wrong and we want to stand up to it, that's good. That's not bad. That's not the same as using anger to destroy people or to hurt others. And when we talked about that and we started to pray honestly, it was a beautiful thing to watch them be relieved of that tension. It didn't solve the problem. It didn't create an overnight miracle. But it started a pattern of these very authentic prayers that this family could now have about exactly where they were and exactly what they were going through.
And one of the points that you make in the book, and it's tough for us to accept this as Christians, but if we are going to say that God is in control of everything, he's omnipresent, he's omniscient, then we have to also accept that he could stop bad things from happening. And I think it's maybe an oversimplification for us many times to say, well, bad thing happens, the devil. Good thing happens,
right.
This is God. And
right.
But yet, if you're looking at it on a deeper level, you have to also realize that God could have stopped a bad thing from happening. And this is where, I wrote this in my review on Amazon, that I have a list of people that I could probably buy this book for and hand this to them. And if they would read it, it would move them beyond a point where they have simply stopped and walked away from God.
Right.
Because something has happened. Something has happened in their life that they just can't come to grips with. And their perspective is, well, if there was a God, this would not have happened. How do we as believers, Ian, accept that or process that, the idea that a loving God doesn't stop an elderly couple from being robbed and murdered in Chicago on a weekend, that were good people? These are things that you just can't make sense of.
But and maybe you can't make sense of it because it'll never make sense. And that there's a reason why. And here, I'll probably go off the reservation here a little bit, Jim, but bear with me. I believe there's a reason why Jesus spoke in parables. He spoke in parables and allowed us to reflect on the meaning of those parables. If Jesus had wanted to speak in catechisms, he would have spoken in catechisms. But he didn't. And I think that this, to me, it says that we may never know the answer to these. Even Jesus, you know, we talk about, you know, there's that wonderful line that stays with me all the time about, does it not rain equally on the just and the unjust? And so that's a fairly mystical thought. And Jesus, for all of his clarity on other issues, was very very prone to mysticism in his use of stories that still challenge us thousands of years later. And I think that part of that is something we should be willing to just accept, that at a time of crisis, we want everything to kind of fit together, tab A and the slot B, and make perfect sense. But whenever we do that, we risk having the next event coming along that would completely shatter that anyway. So can we live with the frayed edges? Can we live with the loose ends? I've learned to do that, and I learned to do that as a hospital chaplain and as a Christian in general. And I don't know why I have tinnitus. I don't know what is going to ultimately be how I will end life, where I will be, whether I'll be successful or not. What I do know is every step along the way, I'm just going to make the most of every moment that I have, and I'm going to live in my faith. And I hope that that gives me I hope it gives me a very wide margin of error between now and the end of life. And that's all I can hope for. And as a Christian, I hope that that's good enough for God and an eternal reward. But
one of the things my counselor helped me to do in counseling was, he said, you cannot control the events that are happening around you, but you can choose to assign the meaning to them that makes the most sense.
And,
and this really helped me to go through what I went through, you know, losing everything due to the embezzlement of my own brother. Instead of, you know, in the early stages of that, saying this is because I'm stupid, I should have been monitoring things more closely, I deserved this. This means that I should never have been as successful as I was to begin with. I began to assign all of these horrible meanings to this situation. And I remember one counseling session, my counselor was especially frustrated with me, and he began to list off all of the things that he was impressed with about me. He said, he stops me and he says, here you are, you're representing yourself as your own lawyer in a complicated 3-year bankruptcy. And you only went to law school for 1 year. He said, there's something right there that I couldn't do, that most people couldn't do. And he began to rattle off all these things about what I was going through that I could be proud of. And I started turning around my shame into really a badge of pride to say, you know what? I'm in this horrible situation, but I'm fighting my way out of it, and I could be proud of that. And people that are listening right now, you know, I know people are listening. We get regular contacts from people that are contemplating suicide because of their finances. I know that sounds crazy.
No,
I totally
get that.
It is.
I'm so sorry. Yeah.
For people that are going through those kinds of things, Ian, you make the point in your book that and I don't know if you actually say this in these words because I haven't finished reading it, but prayer can change you as the person praying, and it can change how you see the very same factual situation. Nothing has changed. The event is exactly the same, but you now see it in a totally different way that makes it easier for you to manage it just because you prayed.
Well, I wish I'd go back and I'll ask everybody who has the book to scribble those words in there, because you phrased it very well. And that's just how we should be thinking of it, that, you know, that prayer is a lens cleaner. And it helps to wipe off the filters between all the things that we build up, between what we think we want in life and what we need. And when we pray, when we sit down and we really listen for that still small voice of God, it can take us in directions that we never thought we could go. And I pray every day to change me. I don't pray every day for God to change others. Now, many of the prayers that are in the Bible, the angry prayers that are in the Bible, are actually calling on God to change and or kill other people. And I think that there are prayers like that from other people that contributed to the book, and those are in the back there too. I don't agree with that, but I understand it, and I think that sometimes that's what we also have to do, be willing to accept that this is how we're feeling for the moment. This is not how we're always going to feel. And when we pray these things, frequently what we do is we realize afterward, that sounds really silly. You know, listen to that. As I'm writing down these things and then saying them out loud, I can't believe I'm saying them. Maybe I don't really believe them. Or maybe I do for the first 2 months after a crisis. But I think that that's where that's the whole point of processing, and that's the whole role of prayer in processing, is that we're about moving forward from where we are, not justifying how we're going to always stay in this one place and believe this exact same thing. And we're called upon to pray for other people. We're called upon to pray for them to be better, not for them to be punished. But if that's what you have to say, well, then say that. But in the end, I think you'll find, and most people will, that you will begin to let go of all of those angers. And that's why the subtitle of the book is, you know, How to Pray When You're Pissed at God or Anybody Else for that matter, is that sometimes it's the people that are around us that are the ones that are causing us all this pain, and we either hold God responsible for empowering them to do that or for not stopping them from doing that, or we're just mad. And we don't hold God responsible. We're just mad at that person. What a great way to help process pain through prayer. And it's just another tool toward a good, sound, spiritual and mental well-being. And that's where we should all be trying to go every day.
And I understand from my assistant that a copy of my book is on its way to you. But I can tell you, and you'll see this in my story, that the turning point in my healing, spiritually and financially and otherwise, was in August of 2008 when I decided to write a letter of forgiveness to my brother.
There you go.
Even though he had never apologized, taken any credit, admitted what he had done, even though I had a court judgment against him for $5 million that I never was able to collect on, I wrote a letter of forgiveness to him. And this is something that many times people get confused about. The idea that, well, this person, I'll forgive them if they do A, B, and C, and they say these magic words. But I knew that, at that point, so many years had passed that the odds of my brother all of a sudden deciding to change and admit what he had done and try to make good for it in any way was probably not going to happen. So I decided unilaterally to just forgive and let it go and let that anger go. And it really opened up a whole new life for me because, I think of that movie Anger Management. Anger can really, if we don't get rid of that anger, it kills us. We think we're doing something to the person who the anger is directed towards, but it's actually killing you, the one who was angry, isn't it?
Well, and look at what you just talked about. You forgave your brother radically. And that is how we as Christians, we look at that as a reflection of the abundant grace that we receive every day. And, the great tragic theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer referred to that, whenever we withhold forgiveness or whenever we put a lot of conditions on our forgiveness as cheap grace. And I think what you did something very different from that. So cheap grace, as he defined it, was the preaching of forgiveness without requiring repentance, communion without confession. It's grace without discipleship. And so what you were practicing was being a really good disciple. And you were offering the forgiveness that you have come to count on yourself. And it you didn't put any terms on it. You could have, theoretically, but whenever we do, we are hurting ourselves. We're becoming the church lady, from Dana Carvey's character. That's what that character is all about. It's all
well,
about.
Well, isn't that special, Ian?
It's all about judgment. It's all about feeling like we have the right, and we are. And when we release that, we aren't that. And so, in the book, How to Pray When You're Pissed at God, I spend a lot of time with the neurology of forgiveness, of prayer. And ever we can look at the MRIs of people who prayed before, their MRI was taken before they prayed and afterward, and we see their brain function improves. Their physiology improves through prayer. And this is any type of prayer. So I've done a lot of 12-step radio. I've done a lot of radio that's focused on people who are recovering from drug and alcohol addiction, and anger is a big part of all of that. And there's so many stories of people who felt like their whole bodies changed when they learned to forgive the people that had caused them pain that then led to their addictions. And they were able to conquer their addictions only after they were able to conquer a sense of revenge.
This is our final couple of minutes here, and it's been a tremendous hour, and we thank you so much for being with us today.
No, thank you.
Help us to understand what is prayer. You and I, we have this discussion, and we use the word, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred times here during this hour.
Right.
But there might be people listening right now that say, you know, what is it? Do I close my eyes and get down on my knees? Do I have to be in a church? Do I read something that is the prayer? Ian, tell us what prayer is to you, and for those listening who may have never prayed before, don't know how to pray, what do they do if they want to start praying?
Well, the first thing to do is just to be honest. Just speak your truth, and you may, some people tilt their head toward heaven as though that is significant. I don't believe in that kind of geography, but if that sometimes is what feels right, then do that. Prayer is a state of meditation where we look both inward and outward. We look to hear as well as to say. It can be done very fast. A lot of people believe that the best prayers are the shortest prayers. It can be done corporately with many other people in a church, as my tradition is, or freestyle, which I also practice, where I just sort of pray exactly what I'm thinking for as long as I feel like thinking it. And then when I've said it, I stop. And that can go 5 seconds or 3 minutes. So the prayer is taking that time to lower your expectations of yourself, to stop laundry listing the things that you've got to get through today, to stop worrying about the cares that plague us, and to just listen, to say and then listen. And we think about that as being, you know, part of any good, authentic relationship. It's time. There's a time to talk, and then there's a time to listen. And if you can incorporate both aspects of that in your prayer life, the rest will reveal itself. And can I say, since I know this is going to be a Father's Day podcast, Father's Day is a really tough day for a lot of people out there when it comes to prayer. And there's a lot of resentments and a lot of legitimate hard feelings towards some dads that fell short or did horrible things. And so I'm with those people on a Father's Day that they can also help that process of forgiving sometimes what is the unforgivable.
And in our last minute, tell us about the book for people just tuning in. Give us a quick overview of the book and who the book is for. It's called How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. Folks, you can get it at Amazon.com or any of the major booksellers or websites, but Ian, give us a quick 1 minute on the book.
Sure. You can go to howtopraybook.com. Howtopraybook.com is the website that lists sample prayers and shows reflections from some fairly well-known celebrities who have talked about the book or reflected on it. I believe that angry prayer is a three-step process where we have to name what we're experiencing. We have to be willing to proclaim it out loud and then willing to reframe it afterward and accept that God can change the way we're feeling today if we're willing to give God that opportunity. And sometimes that starts with using angry prayer to jumpstart what could be sometimes a very a relationship that's taken a lot of dings over the years. Maybe time to start anew. And angry prayer seems like counterintuitive, but it works, and the Bible tells us it does.
Ian, thank you so much for writing this book, and I'm grateful for it. It's going to change a lot of people's hearts, and I will pray for you, sir, as you continue
thank
to go
you.
Through your struggles.
And you turn.
And then
turn.
I wish
thank
you,
you so
I
much.
Wish you the very best. Thank you so much for being with us.
Enjoyed this hour very much. God bless you.
Thank you. God bless. Ian Punnett, the name of the book, How to Pray When You're Pissed at God. And don't judge the title. Read the book. It's a fantastic book. And I knew it would be because I know Ian's heart from listening to him on the radio over the years. God bless. We'll talk to you next time. To everybody, have a happy Father's Day. This is Jim Paris, here as always, to help you make the most of God's money. Talk to you next time.
been listening to Jim Paris Live. For more information about our program, visit ChristianMoney.com or send an email to jim@ChristianMoney.com. Join us next week for another live program.